Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, a podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I am not Lee White, but I am Will Terry. Mm-hmm. And today we have a special guest.
Yep, we have a special guest. Her name's Mel Chehe. Chehe. There we go. I want to add like too many syllables to it.
Uh-huh.
It's spelled C-E-R-R-I. So I wanted to say cherry, but because I don't have a good Brazilian accent. Lee White couldn't join us. He's out on assignment. He's actually working on another class from SVS Learn. So you're going to want to check that out as soon as that drops. But so excited to talk to her today. She is a Brazilian lettering artist, like lettering illustrator. If you look at her work, it's melcherry.com. It's melcerri.com, or go on Instagram. It's the same, at melcerri on Instagram. And look at her work. It's colorful. She described it in the podcast as loud. I look at it and I'm like happy when I look at it. So what was your big takeaway from talking to her today, Will?
It's how she's always creating, and she's balancing a family and her art, and it's inspiring.
Yeah. I liked how she called it premium hours. So she has what she calls these premium hours, and this is like 4 or 5 hours in a day where she doesn't have interruptions, and she knows that like she has to make something within that time period. And she's like, if I don't have a client job, I'm going to still use those hours to make something. And she's like, what's cool, and this is something that I see all the time with very successful illustrators, is they always have some sort of personal project that they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, okay, I'm not getting work, but I still am making progress and learning and getting better on something. And her personal project, you got to listen to the end to hear what she's doing, because it is it's really cool. I'm excited to see if this thing, you know, really takes on like the wings that she's wanting it to. She's just sort of chipping away at it, but it would be really cool to see that thing get published. One other thing I took away from her, she kind of told the difference between, or shared the difference between kids, having kids and not having kids, and the motivating factor of getting work done after you have kids. She's like, I'm actually more productive with kids. So, and that's been my case too. I think your kids kind of focus you and make you realize like, I don't have all the time in the world, and B, I don't want to have all the time in the world to work on my stuff. I want to spend time with these kids. I want to provide for these kids. So I need to be really efficient with my work. So it's cool to see how she does that. And, I don't know, let's get right down into it. All right. Well, hey Mel, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you could be here.
Yeah.
So, I was not familiar with your work before meeting you online first in email, but I instantly, when I saw it, I fell in love. I have it up on my monitor here. I fell in love with it, and I would like to know, first off, describe what illustration field you operate in, like what segment of the illustration world you operate in. What exactly would you call this?
I do commercial illustration mostly. Mm-hmm. So I work for clients. So let's say a client needs a greeting card, or a client needs some illustration to go on their website, or for some specific communication they're sending out to their own clients. So usually that's where I operate, work for clients, and create illustrations to fit their specific needs. And I do a lot of personal work as well, just to keep practicing and like kind of directing where I want my style to go. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's how I would define it.
How would you describe your style?
I think it's really loud. It's, you know, bold and vibrant. Mm-hmm. I don't work with like muted colors. I usually go for like the big contrast, the really very saturated. When I work with lettering, I like to be very expressive. I mean, I've been through all, you know, the journey to get to this particular style right now. Yeah.
I'm holding up one of her pieces of art. If you're on YouTube, and it says loud, yeah. the lettering.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's been a journey. I've been through many different styles to get here, but this is what I would think is where I'm most comfortable, you know, like mm-hmm. where I'm in my zone is doing really loud, expressive work, working with abstract shapes, you know, just geometric shapes and simple, very simple illustration, like I do hearts and lightning bolts and smiley faces. You know, I am not a person who illustrates like realistic, you know, people, portraits, things like that.
Yeah, I almost like you're bridging the gap between graphic designer and illustrator. And I want to know, like, how did you get there? Like, how did you arrive at this, like working in this way where the words, the letters, the shapes are all very expressive and very much evoke some sort of feeling, but could almost be like exist very, very naturally and comfortably in a graphic design kind of world?
Yeah. It's funny you say it like that because, so I never went to school for illustration specifically. I'm an advertising major, and I wanted to become an art director when I was in college. And when I was in college, I started doing freelance design work with my now husband. He was my friend in college, and we just started freelancing as a graphic designer, and I stayed that way as a freelance graphic designer for over 10 years. But I always loved, you know, drawing. I've always loved typography. So I was doing it on the side just for fun, just practicing, just, you know, silly things on the side. And slowly, you know, I found out that lettering could become a career, which I didn't know. I thought it was like just fonts. And I started investing in that, like, okay, maybe one day in the future I could become a lettering artist. So let's start practicing more and more. And that's kind of how it started. And slowly I stopped working as a graphic designer and started just doing more and more client work as an illustrator. So I feel like graphic design is my, like, it's my bedrock, you know, it's where I'm super safe. And slowly, I'm still starting out as an illustrator, I feel. So I'm slowly, you know, branching out and exploring other kinds of illustrative paths for me. So yeah, I feel like very much of my work is still rooted in graphic design because it's what I've been doing for the past 10 years. Now I don't do it anymore, but it's a recent thing.
So yeah. How long have you been doing this more illustrative style?
Around 6 years ago, I started practicing lettering and then like I was picked up by a representation agency in the US. And that's when I really started getting more client work, which was 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. But only in 2021 is that I like left my last graphic design client behind, said goodbye, said I don't want to do this anymore. I want to be an illustrator. And so it's super recent that I can call myself only an illustrator and not anything else anymore.
That's awesome. Only congratulations.
Only an illustrator. Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, I was looking at your work and I've talked about this before on the podcast that I used to work in graphic design as well. And my boss really pushed me towards doing basically what you're doing, hand lettering. I took a class in college on hand lettering, and I even pushed to illustrate the hand lettering on a couple of my books.
Cool.
So I love designing letters like you do. It's a neat skill for illustrators to have.
Absolutely.
It makes you more marketable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it was super comfortable for me when I was starting, because you can't, like, you have these very specific rules you have to follow. You have predefined shapes you want to, you know, nail. So it's a lot easier to start. For me, it was a lot easier to start with letters than it is to, like, let's draw a human figure, or like a landscape, or, you know, because it's so wide open. With letters, mm-hmm. you it's not that open. You have very specific guidelines and rules, and, you know, so it was easier. And also, I really love typography, so I felt super comfortable there, exploring and growing in that direction first.
Mm-hmm. So were you getting prior to getting the work with the agency, how were you getting your client work that you're doing?
Via word of mouth, mostly. Just word of mouth. Friends. And, you know, I had an Instagram, which was, mm-hmm. Instagram was still good in pushing out your work to new people. So I had an Instagram page that I started uploading my stuff to. But I was always been like super shy in selling myself. So I don't think I would have gotten to where I am today without the agency, because they really helped me grow and push and just be better at trying out new styles, and also like just facing your fears as an illustrator. Like, your imposter syndrome is going to be there. It's going to be screaming, mm-hmm. but you just got to go and, you know, sell yourself if that's something you want to live off of.
Right. Yeah. So we get this question so many times. I don't know if you get it a lot too, but how do you get an agent? Right. So I want to ask you, how did you get your agent?
Oh my God. It was really kind of a lucky break. I was following him. This Drew, who is my agent, he was an illustrator as well. He was a lettering artist. So I was just following him on Instagram. And then he went through a career change, and he decided that he would be much better at representing artists than as an artist himself. So he was going through that change. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, you know, Drew Melton stopped being Drew Melton on Instagram and changed to Closer and Closer. And I was like, what's Closer and Closer? When did I start following these people? But, you know, they posted good stuff. So I was following them. And then mm-hmm. one time he posted something, and I just commented, oh my God, there are so many. He posted like, it was a portfolio of the artists he was representing at the time. Yeah. And I commented like, oh my God, so many great artists here, something like that. And mm-hmm. that comment made him go into my Instagram page, and then he saw what I was posting, and he was like, oh, you have some good stuff, let's talk. Oh. Yeah. And that's how I got like in, and I'm like so grateful to be in. Right. Every year I'm like, oh my God.
the one time you weren't shy.
Yes, exactly.
And exactly. It worked in your favor.
You know, I was really lucky. You know, he was starting out, he was looking for new artists. Now it's like a huge roster with many people, and mm-hmm. I feel like he's much more picky as to who gets mm-hmm. in now. So I would say, if you're not as lucky as I was, that it's really important that you find the style that you excel most at, you know, like you're really mm-hmm. happy with your work. You're really flowing well mm-hmm. with your work. And then don't be shy about pushing it and sending your portfolio to the agencies, because they are always looking for, like, the roster is always changing. So mm-hmm. you kind of have to be on their mind to mm-hmm. be picked.
Yeah. That's super cool.
You're living in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
Is your agent also in Brazil?
No, he represents me only in the US.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yes. If you go to closerandcloser.co, you'll see, really, it is a kind of a vibe that he's got going, like a very specific, I could see who would not be someone he's interested in, and I could see definitely the kind of artist that he would, and you fit into that really well. But yet each of these artists is doing something a little different that no one else does. So I would say, you know, to kind of follow up on this strategy for people listening, it's like, make sure you're creating artwork that looks like something valuable, you know, something that clients want. Two, reach out to agents, but look at agencies that are doing and representing the kind of work that you're doing. Because if I sent him my work and said, hey, would you be interested in representing me? I know it'd be a flat no, because I'm not doing, you know, this my stuff, I don't think, is this trendy. Like, it's the stuff is really, really cool stuff. I actually know one of these other artists on here as well. What's his name? Dave Arcade. He's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He's based in Utah, Will.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's such a funny guy.
Yeah, he is. He is. I think we had a phone call once. So I want to ask you, the way you work, it's obviously digital on some level, but I see you're also doing some traditional stuff as well. I'm just curious where you're most comfortable, what tools do you like using, and how you go about making this stuff?
Yeah, well, coming from graphic design, I'm very comfortable with vector, mostly vector, more than Photoshop, honestly. So I'm okay with finalizing art in vector form if client needs, but it's not my favorite one. It's not my favorite medium to work in right now. Mm-hmm. I have been just doing a lot of digital drawing on Procreate on the iPad. That's been my, like, if I have if I have very little time, I just work on Procreate.
It's such a good tool.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a game changer, I feel, for me. Like, it made my work much faster and much more, you know, streamlined, just because revisions are much faster than on paper on Procreate. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been doing mostly, you know, just Procreate. But I do love traditional mediums. I love working with markers. I mean, I feel like I'm a child when it comes to illustration. Like, what do you love to write? Markers.
Yeah. Crayons, markers.
You know? Crayons. But I love working with, like, very pigmented markers. And I've also done some murals, hand painting some murals as well. Yeah, like that one.
So I'm holding one up, and I have a question on that. Are these murals in the US or are they in Brazil?
That one was in the US. This was like a dream project for me. The client flew me to New Orleans and I stayed there at a hotel for a week. And I went to the event and live painted it in front of the, you know, people who were going to the event. It was 17,000 people. It was huge. And it was an amazing, amazing project because I had a lot of freedom. The client was like, we just want you to do your thing. The only thing we want is this word. And I got to meet people, talk to people, which is something I, you know, don't usually get to do because I work alone. Mm-hmm. So it was, I really hope
I'm looking at on your website, you've got all these photos of you making it, and there's just like hundreds of people walking past, like watching and looking at it. And you've got this cool like jumpsuit that you're wearing too, with like paint all over it. You look like a real artist, like getting your hands dirty and doing stuff.
We're not real artists.
No, we're just,
we don't have paint all over us.
No. But so how many murals have you done now?
I don't know the exact number. Let me think. Not that many. It's under 10 for sure. Mm-hmm. But it's because, you know, I was on a roll and then I had a baby and then things changed completely, you know. murals take, you know, take a lot of commitment, you know. Mm-hmm. You have to be there the whole day, and with a baby that was impossible. And mm-hmm. then after I had her, I just never picked it back up. But I would be, just because it's a big commitment of time. Yeah. You know, I was listening to your podcast, and you were talking about how children's books are like a marathon. And I was mm-hmm. thinking, I would never be able to work on something like that, just because I need to push out my stuff so quickly. You know, turnaround mm-hmm. has to be so fast. Although I would love to one day, maybe. and murals are the same. Like you have to be able to book, like, this week I'm doing this thing, and it takes many, many hours in the day, and I still haven't been able to make my schedule work around mm-hmm. murals again.
How old's your daughter?
My oldest is 2 and my youngest is just 8 months old.
Oh, wow. two kids. Yeah. Congratulations.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you.
So murals are kind of like, if I understand it, it's typically something that the client wants done in as short amount of time as possible. Like, they don't want a mural to take 2 months. They want it to be like done in a week. Yeah. Or a day if they could, right? Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Exactly. I didn't know that. How do you, I'm curious about murals, because this is something that I've never really done. And it's always sort of fascinating to me. It looks kind of tedious but fun as well, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how do you do it? What's the process start to finish? I assume it starts on paper or on your iPad. You're figuring it out. But then how do you get it on the wall?
Well, there are a bunch of ways you can look. Okay, so you start on paper or mm-hmm. digitally. You have to consider, like, the texture of the wall. So if it's too textured, you can put a lot of detail. If it's mm-hmm. If it's, you know, internal, if it's on the outside, what the weather is going to be like, a bunch of things you have to consider just regarding the wall itself. Then to get the artwork onto the wall, I usually use a projector if there's enough, you know, space to place the projector, and I just trace it with a pencil and mm-hmm. then go in with paint after. That's the easiest way. But mm-hmm. you can do like a grid method, like, you know, mm-hmm. you grid it out and then you retrace it. And you can freehand it as well. If it's something simple, you can also freehand it. There are a lot of muralists who freehand, but it's
hard. I'd be so freaked out about that, because I know yeah. one of the eyes would be like massive uh-huh. and the other one would be like too small, and because of my perspective yeah. was wrong.
It's really hard. I've never freehanded anything. I've worked with grid and I've worked mm-hmm. with projector.
How do you know, like, how much paint you need? Like, just a practical thing like that.
I think it works. I mean, I think it's like any other thing. It comes with practice. You have to mm-hmm. have done a bunch of murals to kind of know. But, you know, I buy paint at, it's not like a special paint. It's paint from that you would use to paint your walls anyway. So mm-hmm. you can kind of calculate the square meters or square feet in your case, and how much you're going to need for your specific mural. But it can change a lot as well, because of texture, it takes up a lot more paint. And then mm-hmm. some colors need more coats than other colors. So yellows are terrible, or reds are also can be hard. So you kind of need to practice there mm-hmm. to get really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned imposter syndrome. what would your advice be to someone up and coming who might be listening, who hasn't been to a formal art school, who thinks they're doing pretty good, but they're not really sure where they fit in to the illustration landscape, and maybe they haven't had a ton of success yet, but what would you say to someone like that who feels that they might have that?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'm not the best person to give advice on that, because I really feel like I'm an imposter sometimes. You know, it's hard not having been to school, you know, to formal training. You feel sometimes you feel like maybe you're not as good as other people who have, you know, and I understand that that's normal, but I would say it's irrelevant, you know. Is it relevant if you're getting work and if mm-hmm. your clients are happy and if you are happy with what you're creating, then why is it relevant what your background is, you know? That's mm-hmm. that's what I try to tell myself. Like, I'm really proud of the work I do. I really am. I like what I do and it makes me happy and I love doing it. You know, when I'm working, I'm so in the zone, you know, so mm-hmm. it feels right. So if it feels right for you and clients are happy, then what else is there that you're looking for? Right.
Right.
That's what I would say. Imposter syndrome, you know, it's always going to exist. I mean, there are many experienced, amazing illustrators who feel it. And mm-hmm. it's normal. It's human to feel insecure and, you know, compare yourself to others. But if it's not a helpful thing, then you can think about it, but you can't let it run the show. You have to mm-hmm. push forward anyway.
Yeah, it's sad to me when, you know, a lot of artists, myself included, when I first started out, I wanted the market to define me, or I thought I wanted the market to define me, when really it's me. Only I can define myself.
Mm-hmm.
And my validation, you know, if you look at artists through history, a lot of artists had to fight against what was popular and what was in demand, and they had to go their own way and they had to do their own thing, and they were never getting commissions to, you know, a commission reaffirms your it validates you, right? Or mm-hmm. or getting accepted by an agent or a rep is a validation.
So
somehow as artists we need to not necessarily seek the approval of others, but really, really feel the drive that we have within to fuel our work.
You know, I always think of it like when a kid is doing something that they really love, they are never thinking, am I good at this? Why am I doing this? Is this a side hustle? Am I going to get some money out of this? And, you know, would clients like this? You know, kids just do things because they want to do it and then go ahead and do it. Right. They don't add all these layers of thought processes in front of their decision to just go ahead and do something. And illustration for me is exactly like that. You know, I would be doing it even if it wasn't my career, I would still be doing it for fun. So why do I take the fun out of it completely by thinking, are clients going to like this? Is this trendy? You know, is this? So I try to remind myself of that. To try and stop all the thinking that goes around it and just do what feels right. I think it's the best path. It has been the best path for me anyway, to find my space in illustration.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. I have this theory that there's like three reasons that people make art. And number one is just this innate need to create. And then number two is they're not good at anything else and they have to make a living somehow. So they're going to create art for survival, essentially, like physical, to provide for physical needs. And then three, they use art for like community. Like they need some sort of validation, or they need to use it as commentary. For as of those three things, you know, using art to be a part of a conversation, using art for self-fulfillment, or using art to like as a means to an end to provide for yourself. Where do you fall mm-hmm. on that spectrum, or is it a little bit of all of them?
I think definitely number one is like the main thing for mm-hmm. me. I really just need to be creating stuff. I think it's the one thing I've always done throughout my life, you know? Mm-hmm. So definitely one. And then two is like the happy icing on the cake. Like it's a good thing that I found a way to make money out of something that I love. Like mm-hmm. when I tell my daughter, Mama's working right now, and I'm like drawing on a piece of paper. It's ridiculous, right? It's ridiculous. And my husband makes fun of me all the time because it's like, yeah, Mama's working right now. Because, right. But it's I feel so blessed to have found a way and to have had people cross my path and make this happen, that I get to make a living out of something that I would be doing anyway, and that I love to do.
So I'm curious about, you know, couples who one's a creator, one's an artist, they have kids. I'm curious about the division of labor. How do you, mm-hmm. Where's your life balance? Like, how do you manage, you know, the home life versus the work life? I assume you work at home as well, or do you have a yeah. studio that you go to? Okay. So I'm just wondering how you do that.
Currently things are a little crazy because, you know, I have a small baby who's still breastfeeding. So there's not mm-hmm. really much of a structured schedule. Mm-hmm. My husband also he's a graphic designer. He works from home mm-hmm. as well. So we split everything as much as we can. When he's got something, then I'm with the kids more and vice versa. Mm. And I'm lucky enough to have a person that comes and helps around the house every day because it's been kind of crazy with two kids at home all mm-hmm. day. So honestly, it's been kind of hectic this past few months, but you know, somehow we made it work. Whenever there's a window of space, I try to be really focused and work really hard. Kids have made me much more efficient. That's what I feel. There is zero room for procrastination. There's yep. zero room for like, oh, let's just browse the web for now. No, it's like when I have a window, it's go, go, go. And, mm-hmm. and I feel like I've worked a lot more these past 2 years than I have before I had kids, just because it's made me a lot more focused.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you balance making stuff with marketing stuff? Do you just hand that all over to your agent, or do you use social media to try and get more work or to try and grow an audience for your work like, I'm just curious how you balance mm-hmm. between that. Like, and then also, when do you do personal work as well? So that's a very mm-hmm. layered question, but I'm curious mm-hmm. how that all works for you.
Well, I try to do personal work whenever I don't have client work. So I have a few, what I call the premium hours of my day. That's mm-hmm. when my oldest daughter is in school. So I have like 4 or 5 hours that are my premium hours. Mm-hmm. If I don't have any client work that's going to happen during those hours, then I focus on doing personal work. Like I work on personal projects that I have that are going on, or I start something new, or I, you know, practice something that I've been meaning to practice. And about marketing, well, I'm terrible at it. I'm really terrible.
And you're like all the other illustrators.
Yes. No, there are a few, like, few very good ones, and then the rest of us. I feel like I was not born for social media, you know, but I have to do it, so I do it. Mm-hmm. I try to post everything I do to Instagram, which is the one that I use the most. And then when I have a big project, I upload it to Behance because Behance is a little bit easier, more controlled, and you only have to, you know, to update it like once a quarter, it's fine. You mm-hmm. don't have to do it all the time like Instagram. And I have in the past sent emails to past clients, but I haven't done it recently, but I should get back to that. But honestly, I feel like super self-conscious to just go in and say, hi, remember me? We worked in 2018. Here's what I've been doing recently, which is silly. You know, they don't have, they're fine with, I feel like they're fine with getting those emails. But I feel super self-conscious about doing that. So I haven't
done anything. Here, I know a way to make it not self-conscious. Okay.
Oh, cool.
You ready for this? Because yes. I used to work for, I used to work for a studio. It was like a commercial. We made commercials, like animations for commercials. And we used a lot of like outside talent that we would like, oh, for this commercial, let's get this guy to do this thing. And so what we would get like around Christmas time are like cards from these people just saying, you know, Merry Christmas. Hope you guys had a good year. And it's their artwork. Like, here's something they made. And then maybe sometime in the middle of the year, there'd just be like another postcard or another, like a physical thing, not an email. And it was just a way for them to like touch base. Like, you know, it'd be a happy new year or it'd be spring is here. You know, you kind of use the shifting, the kind of the shifting of seasons and time to have an excuse to create something personal and then send it over. And it just kept them in our minds and be like, oh yeah, that guy, let's, you know, contact her or something. So that's just it's just an idea, just an option. It's you could do an email idea, version of it too, you know?
Yeah. But I think, you know, how many emails do they get a day? Right. So a physical thing is much more memorable, I think. It's sad that we don't send them as much as we did before. But yeah, I think it's actually the most effective kind of marketing you can do because it's personal. You know, when you talk directly to your client, the person knows you, he knows how you work. He already is familiar with you, and knows that you're answer fast or you're on time. You don't, you know, deliver files the way they want them. So I feel like it's the most effective. It's much more effective than just, you know, just posting your artwork on Instagram to a huge audience that don't even relate to you.
Right.
But I think that the fact that it is personal is what makes me a little bit shyer, you know, in doing it. But I know that Closer and Closer does. They reach out to past clients all the time. So I trust that they're doing that for me as well.
Well, you keep getting work, right? So something, yeah. Something right.
Yeah.
You also mentioned that the mural job was kind of a dream project.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what else is on your horizon of dream projects that you would love to be able to do that you maybe haven't been able to do yet?
I would love to do a book cover. I've never done a book cover. I think it would be so cool to have like a physical thing. I have the dream of illustrating a children's book, but that's like in the future. There's a lettering artist that I really love. Her name is Jessica Hish. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
I was going to ask if you were a fan. She's awesome. Yeah,
I'm a huge fan. She's awesome. And she did that. Like she did a children's book, three, I think, now. So it's possible for us lettering artists who are not writers, who are not, you know, maybe not professional illustrators in the children's book scene to do something like that. So, I think those two are my big ones right now. Editorial work.
You know, the funny thing about children's books is for a lot of us, I think, is by the time our children's books come out, those of us that are having kids, you know, the kids are often too old to appreciate if we do the younger ones. That happened to me, you know. Yeah. So I got into it just a little bit too late, and And I could never really read my books to my kids. In fact, one of my kids' friends, the friends came over one time and they're like, they're seeing me in their painting. This was back when I was painting in acrylic. And my kids' friends are like coming into my office and like just looking over my shoulder, like, he's painting, you know, like, and my son goes, yeah, he paints baby stuff for babies, you know, let's go play, you know? And I was like, oh man,
that was Aaron, wasn't it?
I'm nothing.
That was Aaron. Well, he said that, right?
It was Aaron.
You can save like them for when you have grandkids. It will be sweet as well.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, grandkids are right around the corner, aren't they, Will?
Yeah. Well, we have our first one, so
there you go.
Yeah.
Yay.
I wanted to ask you too. So you've got your future dream projects, but what's like super exciting for you right now? Personal work or client work or whatever. Like what is like really getting you going?
I'm working on a personal project. I've been kind of planning and thinking about it for a year now. Mm-hmm. And I want to do illustration over photography, mm-hmm. kind of collage, but it's not really collage because I'm just drawing. And it's about family stories. So my grandfather was the first surfer here in Brazil, and he has this beautiful photograph of him with this big, long surfboard. And I was like, this is such a cool story. Is there a way I can tell this story to other people about, you know, how my grandfather became the first Brazilian surfer? And maybe, you know, merge illustration with storytelling. So I'm kind of trying to get that project off the ground right now. Mm-hmm. I have two illustrations, and the idea is to ask other people to send in their beautiful family stories, interesting or even tragic, you know, just things that you want to tell the world, stories that are just too good to be kept in just in the family, and maybe get images to illustrate that. So kind of like a Humans of New York, but from the past, and that's with cool. illustration on top.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's something that I'm really excited, because I want to, like, I get to talk to other people and meet new people and hear about their families. And to me, that's the most valuable thing, like to the interaction, the exchange that's going to happen if I can get the project going.
Yeah, that's awesome. First surfer in Brazil. That's incredible.
Yeah. Right?
How did he discover it?
Like the surfboard was so huge. So his uncle brought a magazine from the US called Popular Mechanics. I don't know if it still exists.
Yeah.
And it had the plans of how you build what was then called a Hawaiian board, which mm-hmm. is the surfboard, and it was made out of wood. So my uncle had a shop, like a space where you can work with your hands and stuff. Yeah. I don't know how to call that.
A workshop.
A workshop, yes. And my grandfather was like a teenager at the time, thought that was so cool. He lived on a beach and he was like, okay, maybe I'll try to build one of those Hawaiian boards. And he did. And that's how he became the first surfer in Brazil, him and a best friend.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I watched a show one time, and I can't remember the name of the surfer. It was either Kelly Slater or somebody in that age group. And he brought the first stubby surfboard to Brazil and gave it to one of the kids, because they just didn't have surfboards or anything. And anyway, that's,
I can't imagine. Really have you tried surfing?
Yeah, I'm too big.
It's hard. Have you, Mel? Have you tried?
I haven't.
Too?
No, no.
You've got to be able to pop from your chest to your feet.
Yeah.
Really, like you have to be able to push up from your chest to your feet.
And that's after you're dog tired from swimming out past the breakwater, right. Like over and over and over again. Oh, man. I can't imagine surfing on a wooden board, though. Like,
that's... It was huge. You know, stand-up paddle? You know, the like the long...
The paddle boards.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so it was something, like, really long like that, made out of wood, super heavy, needed two people to carry it to the beach. And the photo of him is really funny because he's like a tiny, tiny little man. And then like the board, like huge like that. So it's such a cool photo and such a cool story. I was like, you know, people need to hear about this. And the other story that I already have illustrated is my husband's grandma. When, so there were, they're both Spanish, their grandparents. And it was after the war, they wanted to move to Brazil. But her father wouldn't let her move to Brazil unmarried, but also didn't want them to get married in Spain and move to Brazil because he wasn't sure if they would be able to support themselves here. Mm-hmm. So what they did is her father said, you, the husband, go to Brazil and you get a job. And if you do get a job, then you can marry apart from each other. So she got married to him in Spain. And he was in Brazil. It was the weirdest thing. It was a marriage apart. Yes. She went into the church wearing black and got married alone. And he went into the church here in Brazil and got married alone as well. And then she was allowed to come to Brazil to be with him.
That's so it was interesting.
Such a cool, right? I didn't even know they did that.
That's cool.
How can you get married apart?
So what's the photo that you... work off
it's
of
just
for
her
that.
It's just her addressed as a bride. It's a beautiful image of her alone. Alone.
That's poignant. I'll have to send you my wife's grandfather. When he was a baby, was left at the doorstep of an orphanage in a basket with a note.
Oh my god.
With a note that said, I'm so sorry I couldn't keep you. You know, please take care of him. Someday I'll return to be able to get him. And the way you'll know it's me, he had a ripped dollar bill. And she says, I have the other half of this, so you know I'm your mother. So that you can match him.
And
I always thought that was a cool story.
That's beautiful.
Did they ever get back together?
So it was a mystery that my wife's mom and her aunt finally solved, like through genealogy and through like DNA tests and everything, because they finally figured out who his actual mother was, and they went to the orphanage it's in Canada. He was Canadian, went up there and they met like all of these family members that they had never known before and stuff. But in his life, he never knew who his mother was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Interesting, huh? And he ended up becoming a really successful businessman and like just a amazing guy. Like, you know, the stories I've heard about him. I met him after he had just before he had died, and he had already kind of lost his memory and stuff. But just a cool guy. So there's, you know, you put the word out for family stories and you're gonna have a full book. The hard part will be illustrating all of them.
Exactly. And like, it's so exciting because I love hearing those stories and I feel like other people will like to hear them too.
Yeah. So a couple more questions. Going back to, I guess, the economics behind all of this, and you know, if you're not comfortable sharing like how much a job is, but I'm curious like what the range is for like a mural project, low end, high end. What would the range be for like one of your jobs that you're getting, We have the people who listen to this are a lot of them like, how do I make a living? How do I get into the professional side of this? And one of their big questions is it even sustainable? Is it something that I can, you know, support myself on? I'm just curious about that in regards to this particular kind of illustration work that you do.
It's definitely sustainable, but it helps if you have a style that is commercial. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many really amazing artists, super talented, but maybe their work is too, I don't know, maybe their work just doesn't sell so well, or mm-hmm. there's a limited pool of clients that would need that kind of specific right. work. It's not that they don't sell, but, you know, you need to work harder at mm-hmm. getting clients.
Right.
But yes, it's definitely sustainable. I'm in a lucky position because I live in Brazil and our currency here is really devalued compared to the dollar. Oh. So I earn in dollars and live off our currency in Brazil. So mm-hmm. it's even more comfortable for me here in the sense that I don't need to get as much work to be able to live off of it.
Yeah.
But you know, murals are actually don't pay as well as commercial work just because mm-hmm. there's not much licensing potential there. Mm-hmm. It's just a mural and that's it. It's mm-hmm. it's not usual for clients to use that image afterwards and then you get some money out of licensing it for other usages and everything. I'm not the best person to tell you how much a mural is going for. We usually charge like around for square meters. Mm-hmm. But I can't really tell you the current rate, honestly, because it's been 2 years since I did it. Yeah. Since I did it. But this particular one for Keller Williams, I think they paid me $12,000, something like that.
Okay.
Which was amazing. It was a really good
payday.
Pay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a really good pay. And I got to go to New Orleans and like eat all the amazing food and stay there for a week. It was awesome.
Did you get some oysters while you were there?
I didn't because I hate seafood.
Oh.
But I did not the best place for me, but I did eat a lot of fried chicken, like a lot of fried stuff.
That stuff's good too.
Spicy sauces.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
they could have paid you in fried chicken for that mural and you would have done it.
You know, just the trip itself, you know, it was like, you come here, you work for free and then we send you back and I would be okay. When do I go?
But to our listeners, don't take that deal. You got to get paid for your work. Otherwise you said,
take the chicken deal.
Don't listen to my advice. And then the good thing about having an agent is that they do take a percentage of your pay in closer mm-hmm. and closer, you know, but they also push for the best possible budgets. You know, they also, like, I would never have the stomach even to push for some of these budgets, and they work really, really hard to get you the best possible pay. So you do get a cut, but it's, in my case, completely worth it to work with them.
That's cool. Yeah. Yeah. I was just interested in that. And two, I love that, like, we get to meet you before you're doing book covers and your children's book. And we could say, we knew Mel. We knew Mel when, you know, we had her on the podcast first, you know.
Yeah. And then you can call me back to talk about the books.
Yes, absolutely. That's for sure. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up there. This has been a great conversation. Did you have any follow-up, any questions, Will?
No, it's just a fun career, fun work. You guys should check it out if you haven't. We'll put a link.
Absolutely.
Along with the podcast and also on the YouTube channel. But yeah, the hand lettering thing, that's a great companion to illustration that a lot of, I'm surprised a lot of illustrators don't know how to design type and letters and
there's a alternate universe out there where Jake's main gig is.
Yeah, but the thing is, Jake, you're really good at graphic design. I mean, like, you have.
I love it. I love doing
you're
it.
You're good at it. And a lot of illustrators, like I say, they, for whatever reason, they don't have that skill. And in today's social media world where you, you know, you want to, you kind of have to do a lot of your own marketing. That's a really mm-hmm. good thing to have.
Yeah.
Especially like if you're doing a Kickstarter or anything like that, to be able to have a design sensibility for communication.
You know, just, and I don't know if you did this when you were young, Mel, but like I would like copy letters as close as I could. Like I'd get out a sheet of money and I'd be like, okay, how did they do the D, you know, on that? And I'd do the D with the little serifs on it. And then I'd write my own letters and I'd try to like, okay, if there's no R on here, so let's figure out how an R might look. Is that the kind of thing you did?
Yes. And that's like the best practice for lettering. Like you start with one letter and try to figure out what the alphabet would look like without reference, you know, where the fat parts of the letter are and the thin parts of the letter are. And lettering is like, it's a really good, especially if you work with books. It's a really important skill to have, I feel, because then you can control everything that goes on the cover of the book. Like it's not, you don't have to use a font and try to make it work with your illustration. Right. You control it 100%. Everything is illustrated there. Yeah. So I feel like it's a really, and you know, if you illustrate like complex shapes and stuff, it's really easy to jump to letters. Like you guys can do it. So I encourage every one of you to give it a hand, try it out.
All right. So that was Mel. How we pronounce her last name? Cherhe. Yeah. That was cool. Really interesting. She's super nice too. Like just such a sweet, sweet person. The reason too that I wanted to have her on this podcast is she does work that is completely different from what you, me, and Lee do. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be just interesting and kind of nice for our listeners, because I myself was, and I know if I'm interested in it, the listener is going to be interested in it as well.
And there's a lot of people that listen to us that probably want to do hand lettering or, you know, more graphic work. One of the things that she mentioned a couple of times that I took away was she said that she mentioned that she would do this work, you know, the feeling of wanting to do it for free, you know, just doing it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that's when I know I'm dealing with a true artist. I think I've known a few people that have actually gotten into illustration over the years that didn't last. And that was the thing they were missing, was that passion to create no matter what, you know? And that is also our downfall as illustrators, because we love our work so much that we're almost willing to do it for free. And that's one reason why we don't often get paid as much as we should. And so that's something to consider. I just made a YouTube video on my YouTube channel at Will Terry about how to get more money for the illustration work that you're doing to tackle this very thing. But yeah, that she's a great personality.
Cool. Well, I'll take us out. And by the way, check out her website. We mentioned it at the beginning, but check out her website. It's Mel, we'll spell it, MelCerri.com. And you can follow her on Instagram also at it's at MelCerri, and really just doing some cool stuff over there on Instagram as well. All right, everybody, 3-Point Perspective is made possible by SVS Learn, where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts today have been Will Terry and Jake Parker. Again, Lee was out on assignment, so he couldn't join us today. But you can find Will Terry's work at willterry.com. You can also find his work on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White's work, you can find at leewhiteillustration.com and at Instagram on Lee White Illo, or on Instagram at Lee White Illo. And my work's over at jakeparkerart.com, and I'm on Instagram at Jake Parker. Podcast produced by Daniel Tu, that's Daniel T-U, and you can find his work at daniel2.co. Special thanks to Master of Production, David Bro. keeper of the curriculum, Austin Shirtliff, and boy, is he keeping the curriculum lately, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's given us lots of notes. We appreciate it. Chief Operations Officer Lisa Fott, and a thank you to Lily Howell for our show notes. Now, go draw something.